Are we looking forward to seeing Rush tonight?
Of course.
Oh, guaranteed. Yeah.
Okay, what's so good about him?
Neil Peart.
Yeah. That's it? You don't care about the other guys?
Who?
What do you think? What do you like about Rush?
Oh, Alex Lifeson all the way, man.
Mm-hmm.
So he's cool.
Geddy and Neil don't mean anything to you.
Oh, they got to be there to make Alex look good, right? That's all it is, man.
You look like a Rush fan?
Oh, yeah.
What do you like about him?
Drums. Neil Peart.
He's the greatest drummer in rock music.
Oh, yeah. Well, Rush, you know, they're pretty good.
Uh-huh. What do you like specifically? Is it music or lyrics or...?
Stage performance, what I heard about, right?
But the lyrics, what do you say to
me? No, that's the lyrics, man.
What do you mean that's lyrics?
The music.
The music?
The music?
Yeah.
No, the lyrics.
No, the lyrics. The lyrics.
What's it?
Bang, got to say.
This is a world album premiere. Snakes and Arrows by Rush. Featuring a rare radio interview with drummer and lyricist Neil Peart. To take you on a journey inside the making of this new CD, here's your host, Paul Morris.
Hi, everybody, and here it is, Snakes and Arrows, the first new Rush album of original material in 5 years. For the first time in their careers, Geddy, Alex, and Neil have been heard to say that they believe Snakes and Arrows contains the best work of their 3 decades together.
Yeah, I did make the comment that the day my drum tracks were finished, I said to the engineer, Rich, and to Nick that I've never enjoyed the recording process so much or felt so satisfied with the results.
Hi, I'm Paul Morris, and today a rare radio interview with the great Neil Peart from his rehearsal room. Even after more than 30 years, we find Neil as excited about the new album as the young Carney boy he once was when growing up in St. Catharines. In the next hour, we'll take you on a journey inside the making of Snakes and Arrows. The new album was born last year in a surge of creative energy. And the boys headed out to a studio in the Catskills with a young, energetic, and inspiring producer named Nick Raskulinich, who they nicknamed Booge.
He's a very inspiring co-producer in that sense that when I had finished what could be a good take of the song, he would send me out again and say, okay, go out there, this time just go crazy. And I would go out and do those spontaneously and sometimes just make it, you know, by the seat of my pants and the skin of my teeth, pull off something fresh, new, daring. And I think the listener senses those kind of things, too, that this guy never played that before, and he only barely made it back to one, you know?
In the next hour, Neil Peart takes us deep into the heart of the album, unlocks the mysteries of the ancient game of Leela, and the personal journey that led to the lyrics that make up Snakes and Arrows.
A lot of the songs are about my relationship with the world and the things I see and what I think about it.
Be prepared to be blown away. This is the world album premiere of Snakes and Arrows, the new album from Rush.
Hello, this is Neil Peart from Rush, and you're listening to the world album premiere of Snakes and Arrows.
Let's get things going with the first single. Here's Far Cry. That's Far Cry, the first single from the new Rush album, Snakes and Arrows, which hit stores on May 1st. The new album was written and recorded quickly in what has been an inspiring year for Rush.
Yes, it was a remarkable process the way this whole album came together, starting just over a year ago in January of 06. We just started exchanging long-distance ideas, and Geddy and Alex lived nearby in Toronto, so they were kind of going over to each other's houses, and I sent up a bunch of lyrics from my present home in California. And then in March of that year, we got together at my place in Quebec, and they played me sketches of the songs they'd been working on, and we discussed changes and improvements and so on, and got excited because, as I had written about these songs, the first time I heard a couple of them, I loved them immediately. And when I first listen, I'm kind of listening as the lyricist to see if the words work, and I'm listening as the drummer because I have to learn that song and play it. Yeah. But in another way, I'm just listening as a fan. I want to love that song, you know, and if all of us don't love a song, it won't get made. That's one of our built-in self-editing modes, that if there's any doubt about a part or about the nature of a transition or something that doesn't satisfy all three of us, then it goes. You can't run a three-piece band on a democracy where two outvote one, because you can have one unhappy person. And in the long term, you know, that's not going to work. So we agreed to get together in May here in Toronto and work together in the same place, and worked on those few songs and a few more, and at the same time made the choice of a co-producer to work with, because we've always found it very valuable to have a fourth person there for different reasons, to comment on what we're doing, to encourage us in arrangements, writing, and performance, and also as an arbiter, if three of us do disagree on something, it can be somebody's enthusiasm to say, guys, no, don't worry, that's good. Or, guys, you're right, maybe you should rethink that part. So that's been an important part of the chemistry for us always, and we've worked with many really good and very close collaborators that way. So we listened to a selection of work by Nick Raskolnikov, who's best known for his work with Foo Fighters, and just something in the spirit of the mixes of that music, it's always hard to determine who did what to whom and if it was the band or the co-producer, but we liked the spirit of it, and when we met him, we liked his spirit even more and his sense of enthusiasm about the music, his ideas for it. His background was as a musician, starting as a drummer, then a bass player, then a guitar player. Then he got interested in the production side and kind of worked from studio to studio. So even at 37, his wealth of experience and confidence was present and gave us, in turn, respect and confidence for his ideas. And when he would give me ideas for drum parts, he would air drum them in the air and had all that kind of rock enthusiasm that was so inspiring for us and such a great part also of the everyday working mood. That took basically September, October. We finished the pre-production and started recording at Alaire Studios down in the Catskills of New York State in November. Ended up using, they had two different studios there, so we were actually recording everything all at the same time. Wow. Just by that perfect mixture of events and the fact that those two facilities were both available. So Alex and the engineer, Rich, were working in one studio on guitar overdubs, and in the other studio, Getty and Nick were working on vocals. So we finished all the recording months quicker than we thought we would. And we're mixing down in Los Angeles by January. So that whole process came together so comfortably and so naturally and with such a great atmosphere among the three of us and including Nick in that too, where every day, you know, work like any other work, it can be difficult. And there was a morning I remember driving in here to Toronto to the demo studio, and I'd been working for 3 days on one of the songs, Good News First, because when I hand in the lyrics, sometimes I overwrite and just know that Getty will select what he responds to and what works being sung, and those are different distinctions, different criteria. And there was this song called Good News First that he had chosen certain parts of the song to sing and other parts not to sing, and the result, and I'm perfectly happy, I'm glad he likes it, you know, I'm glad he found something there to respond to and be inspired by, so there's no negativity about it, but then it becomes my job to try to make sense out of it. And lyrics can be a little bit surreal, and that's fine, and it can be a series of images and metaphors that the listener can respond to in their particular way, and that's all great too. But for me, there has to be an inner logic there, and in a very defined sense, it has to make sense. So for 3 days, I've been struggling on the lyrics for Good News First and wasn't getting anywhere and was getting into that dark mood that I think anyone would understand, where it's like, I can't do this, you know, I give up, I'm not doing this anymore. And came in that day and in about 1 minute found the key that I needed to make that song work the way I needed it, and started on Armor and Sword, which would become one of the main epic themes of the album, and finished that in about an hour. So it was the kind of good day that made the three previous days worthwhile, but it's also those three previous days that made that day possible. So that's part of how the creative cycle can revolve around, you know, in the course of creation.
That's new music from Rush and the song Armor and Sword. I get a sense that this was a really rewarding album to record. What's different this time around than maybe what you've done in the past?
Again, so many factors come into play, and we had a nice amount of time to work on the material, and so we were confident with the arrangements, a great relationship among the three of us and with our co-producer, Nick. And we worked at Alaire Studios, where I had previously done an instructional video there on drum soloing, Anatomy of a Drum Solo. And it's a big old estate with a great-sounding room, formerly the Great Hall, all of cathedral ceiling and beams and wood and walls and stone fireplace and so on. So we had a place where the drums sounded great. And it was the kind of getaway like we used to do to Le Studio in Quebec or several English studios, where we just go away and work. And when you're not working, you're hanging out together. When you are friends, there's a great kind of summer camp, you know, environment about that that was really productive too. But yeah, I did make the comment that the day my drum tracks were finished, I said to the engineer, Rich, and to Nick, that I've never enjoyed the recording process so much or felt so satisfied with the results. And it was partly Nick's... he's a very inspiring co-producer in that sense, that when I had finished what could be a good take of the song, he would send me out again. He'd say, okay, well, this time just go crazy, you know, because I tend to rehearse and compose my drum parts, and because it's the kind of drummer that I am, and try to get it accurate and feeling good and make all the transitions. There's a lot of detail work in drumming that perhaps the layperson might not understand of of the way that you're pushing and pulling time to make the listener feel a certain response to it. So once I've achieved all that, I'm okay with it and can sign off. But Nick would say, go out and play some crazy fills and do this and that. Or how about, you know, this verse that you've done is good, but something maybe more active, and he would air drum something outrageous for me to go and play. And I would go out and do those spontaneously. And sometimes just make it, you know, by the seat of my pants and the skin of my teeth, pull off something fresh, new, daring. And I think the listener senses those kind of things, too, that this guy never played that before, and he only barely made it back to one, you know. So we would keep those as part of the performance. So there was that kind of satisfaction in the fact that I had done the basic job of timekeeping and making transitions and a progression of fills and decorative elements in my drum part. I accomplish all that is satisfying, but then to have that additional spirit that Nick brought to it of being spontaneous and living dangerously, as it were, might go counter to my character and nature of preparation, but certainly is a very strong musical element, and again, something I think communicates to the listener. There's a certain excitement and edginess that those parts convey.
That's Malignant Narcissism, an instrumental that got its title from the movie Team America World Police. It's one of three instrumentals on the new Rush Snakes and Arrows album. The title got its start with Geddy playing on a fretless bass one afternoon between takes, and Neil recording his drum parts in a simple four-piece kit. The track was inspired by their co-producer, Nick Raskulinich. Nick's a self-professed Rush freak whose resume includes the last two Foo Fighters albums and new albums from Stone Sour and Shadows Fall. When Nick heard that Rush was about to begin work on a new album, he had his manager send them a tape of his work. I asked Neil what his expectations were of Raskulinich.
What do you expect of a co-producer when he comes into the studio working with you guys?
I guess the word that occurs to me right away is sympathy in the true sense of, well, I mean, of understanding your music and what you're trying to do.
I see.
And not trying to take you somewhere else or trying to make you a different sort of band or to make a record that you've already made or any of those things. He had to come in and understand what we were trying to do. That's what I mean by sympathy. And hear our demos and go, okay, I hear what you're trying to do here. It, like in my book editor, I call his method critical enthusiasm. He'll say, I like what you've done, but here's how it could be better, you know, and that's the greatest kind of thing to work with because it doesn't undermine you, and it's the way the three of us work among each other, too. If somebody has an idea, you don't immediately say, that's stupid. You say, oh, okay, I see what you're doing, but maybe if we do this, it would be better, or there's something I'm missing here. You find ways to convey it that are critical but enthusiastic. So that was the kind of approach that Nick brought to it as well. But sympathizing with the spirit is what I mean of what we're trying to do.
That's Spindrift off the new album from Rush, which hits stores on May the 1st. Snakes and Arrows will be one of the first albums released in the new music video interactive format. This release will only be available as a limited edition. The album will come out in a deluxe box and will include 13 songs on the album in high-resolution audio, the entire album in 5.1 surround sound, a video documentary on the making of the album, and a special 26-page booklet.
Hello, this is Neil Peer from Rush, and you're listening to the world album premiere of Snakes and Arrows.
Hi everybody, I'm Paul Morris, and today we're celebrating the release of Snakes and Arrows, the first new album of original songs in 5 years. Geddy Lee, Alex Lifeson, and Neil Peart have been at this for 30 years, but the time between albums grows longer and longer as each of the guys keeps busy with many projects. I'm amazed that Neil has any free time to devote to Rush. In the past 5 years, he's been more than busy. There's neilpeart.com, a MySpace page. He's probably the only drummer whose drum kit goes out on tour. There's an appearance on the Mercer Report, and most recently doing voiceover work for a character for the Aqua Teen Hunger Force movie, and much, much more. Somehow he finds time to write, record, rehearse, and tour with Rush. We caught up with Neil at his rehearsal room on the Toronto waterfront and asked if the long time between albums gave him more to draw from.
If you consider the 5 years between Vapor Trails and now, all that we've done, we did two major tours in that time.
Yeah.
I wrote two books and made an instructional video and did a huge amount of traveling professionally and personally. And life experience and what other people are going through in the triumphs and tragedies of their lives, that's 5 years worth of living. And thus, when you digest that into, and I, as I was saying, the lyrics do express my concerns and my preoccupations with the world around me, but that's informed by, yes, 5 years of experience and 5 years of very intense experience. Again, the personal level I mentioned of traveling through those small towns is kind of research. You know, I'm seeing people's lives and the things, the small things that you pass by and maybe don't think about, but if I see a little restaurant closed down or a gas station closed down, that's somebody's dream. Somebody dreamed once of having their own little restaurant or their own little gas station or their own little store, and so many small towns in Canada and the U.S., of course, are fading as times change. And it's sad, but what's really sad is seeing that personal thing. If somebody dreamed all their lives of having that restaurant, and boom, you know. So those are the small kinds of things. I mentioned that one example as just an insight that came to me one day, that's what I was looking at, you know, was someone's life shattered. And in people close to you, too, of course, you see the tribulations that everybody goes through. And yes, the point you make is absolutely true, that 5 years does make a huge difference in the amount of material that you're able to bring to a fresh piece of work.
Tell me about some of the lyrical themes that are behind some of the songs on this record. Is there a common thread that runs through this entire album?
Almost always, of course, because it's me writing about what I'm thinking about, there are common kind of preconceptions that I have at the time, predilections that I have at the time. And we had just finished the 30th anniversary tour the year before in 2004, and then I wrote the book about that roadshow. And as I was going through my experiences of traveling, I did 21,000 miles of motorcycling on that tour, the back roads of America and Canada and Europe. And the things that I was seeing are life. You know, other people at work and other people at play is something that I'm exposed to that's not part of the normal touring environment. Usually if you're going from your airplane to the hotel to the gig and all that, you're not seeing that whole side of life that I first started experiencing by bicycle in the 80s when I took a bicycle on tour with me. And then 10 years ago when I started doing all my traveling by motorcycle, it gave me, of course, a much broader ability to travel completely independently now. So when I was traveling through the U.S., for example, and seeing the prevalence of evangelical Christianity, the signs in front of churches are a big part of the book Roadshow. And at first I was just reporting them as part of the landscape, but then it started to disturb me, you know, the presumptuousness of it, that this is what we think and this is what you should think too. In the book context, I reached a certain crisis point where I had to say, okay, I can't keep quiet anymore, and I had to speak up and speak my mind about it. But in doing so, I also wanted to accentuate the positive, if I could. What are the good things? You know, if I'm personally, the song Faithless is a good example. I have my own moral compass. I have my own spirit level. Those are the metaphors that I chose to use there. I kind of know what's right and wrong, and I know what's good and bad for me and the way to treat other people. I have that without any necessity for an outside faith, but other people have faith in the good thing that it does for them. It can be a consolation for them. It can answer all those uncomfortable questions. It can give them a sense of community and support. And I thought, and the sense of spirituality, something better than yourself, bigger than yourself, meditation, morality, these are all okay things. And they're a kind of protection. So they became the armor side of the metaphor. The bad kind of faith, of course, is militant, the kind that comes at you with a sword. So that became a basic metaphor for the song Armor and Sword, but it's also a basic theme that does run throughout the album. But there are other tangents I got into. I found a new way to go at relationship songs, too, because a lot of the songs are about my relationship with the world and the things I see and what I think about it. I thought, what if I made that in terms of the classic person-in-person relationship song? And I remembered Robert Frost's epitaph was, I had a lover's quarrel with the world. And I thought of that as a device that I could use. And I guess two or three of the songs use exactly that device, where I write it as if it were a man and a woman disagreeing, or, you know, two sides of a couple disagreeing. And in fact, it's about me disagreeing with a whole bunch of other people. So that was another kind of a way to weave those worldly concerns into a more personal presentation.
The new album is called Snakes and Arrows. Where did you come up with the name?
Yeah.
How did you come to this?
Yeah.
And how does it fit into this album, and how did you arrive at the name?
Yeah, it's one of those beautiful accidents, really. When I was working on the lyrics for Armor and Sword, I got into the idea, and Richard Dawkins echoes this thought too in The God Delusion, which I've just read, is about children, you know, and the fact that in terms of faith and in so many other ways, we are imprinted and we are biologically, Darwinianly engineered to obey our parents. Don't jump in that fire, you know, don't dive off that cliff. So I was thinking about the impact that parents and society in general has on children. So I was thinking the snakes and arrows a child is heir to are enough to leave 1,000 cuts. And I was looking at myself and other people I know, how we are shaped as adults so much by what happened to us as children. Our parents and our church and our schools and our friends and the bullies at school, and all of that becomes a part of who we are forever. So that